are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
We believe in the authority of reason and conscience. The ultimate arbiter in religion is not a church, nor a document, nor an official, but the personal choice and decision of the individual. We believe in the unity of experience. There is no fundamental conflict between faith and knowledge, religion and the world, the sacred and the secular, since they all have their source in the same reality. We believe in the worth and dignity of each human being. All people on earth have an equal claim to life, liberty and justice, and no idea, ideal or philosophy is superior to a single life. We believe in the ethical application of religion. Good works are the natural product of a good faith, the evidence of an inner grace that finds completion in social and community involvement. We believe in the motive force of love. The governing principle in human relationships is the principle of love, which always seeks the welfare of others and never seeks to hurt or destroy. We believe in the necessity of the democratic process. Records are open to scrutiny. Elections are open to members. And ideas are open to criticism, so that people might govern themselves. We believe in the importance of a religious community. The validation of experience requires the confirmation of peers who provide a critical platform along with a network of mutual support. These words are by David O. Rankin.
It's our tradition to share the significant events of our spiritual lives in an open form of fellowship. I invite you now to deepen and bind that relationship by sharing any recent event that's been significant in your spiritual life. An event can be a thought, an insight. Light a candle from our chalice and tell us briefly about it. You may prefer to light a candle in silence. Listening with an open heart and mind is the most important part of this practice. We'll have a short meditation today using some words from Stephanie Dowrick. So it won't be very, very long, but I'll sound a bell at the end of the silent time. These are the few words that I think are particularly relevant today. Generosity arises out of an intention to care way beyond the limits of one's own self or the group to which one is immediately attached. It is expressed in a thousand ways. Giving something up for the sake of someone else, doing without what is acquired at another's cost, extending your borders between us and them, go a long way to spreading goodwill and peace. recently I've been thinking a lot about clothes, their power to oppress people, but also to advance justice. And if this sounds far-fetched, I invite you to reach deep into the pockets of the clothes that you're currently wearing. Go ahead, try it. If you're wearing clothes traditionally marketed to men, your pockets are likely to hold your entire hand, a wallet, maybe even your mobile phone. But if you are wearing clothes traditionally marketed to women, your clothes likely do not have pockets, or the pockets are so small you're struggling to even fit your pinky inside. Or they're quite fake, stitched up, literally. We associate pockets with masculinity, and that's why I asked Brendan to play cool. In kids' lit, especially in the olden days, boys always had their pockets full of interesting junk. Marbles, bits of string, you know, Mark Twain, Huck Finn, Tom Sawyer, that sort of stuff. A New York Times article lamented, "Gone are the carefree days when boys crammed their jeans with lizard's eels and slightly used chewing gum. The tentacles of finance are reaching into the pockets of children," and a tirade about bank cards followed. Our pockets, like our fashion choices, are not just a matter of changing trends. The clothes we wear are deeply entwined with issues of gender, capitalism, climate change, labour rights and faith. And the decisions we make around fashion and clothes can actually help us live out our faith and justice practices, embedding them in everyday lives. Stay with pockets. Women's clothes in Europe and the US used to have enormous tied-on pockets hidden under skirts. In the late 1700s, garment makers added sewed in pockets to the clothing of people who could own property. People who needed to carry money, documents, or even weapons. So what sort of people was that?
Men.
By the late 18th century, women's clothes became more form-fitting and tied-on pockets were ditched for a tiny pouch in the hand. Might be a copyright issue. Anyway, for this reason, when Portrait of a Lady on Fire was screened in 2019, Celine Sciamma, the director, was challenged about the presence of pockets in her film. Now, she'd done her research. Women did have pockets early in that century, but late in the century they were all but phased out. Apparently, women were not supposed to have secrets. What I learned from the interviews about the film is that before the age of photography, portraiture was a booming industry and literally hundreds of women earned their money as artists painting portraits. You would not guess this from many an old-fashioned art gallery. It's nearly all boys in the portrait gallery. In the 19th century, when the Industrial Revolution and trade swelled the coffers of a burgeoning merchant class, women were trophies to be displayed. So no pockets. Elegance. Not utilitarianism. The age of the lady. The lady who could instruct the gardener how to garden, the cook how to cook, the coachman how to shoe a horse, or the prime minister how to run the country. But she didn't do pockets, because she didn't do a lot. Working women in the fields and factories had pockets for keys, for cash, for... Well, there is a great case in which a young agricultural woman was tried and sentenced for trying to pocket two chickens. So she must have had substantial pockets. Many women's pockets have been external and not... Oh, there it is. That's the little, the punsy little pocket for not a lot of use, but very decorative. It was especially the case when cheap clothes came in, and they were made by machines, so they didn't do inseam pockets like that one there, because this made the dress construction easier with the early sewing machines. Hence, pockets and reticules and the like were either hung on the outside of dresses or beneath a cloak or shawl or apron. Men, of course, had pockets, and young aspiring pickpockets were trained to deal with a variety of challenges. Remember, you got to pick a pocket or two from Oliver? Fagin sings it. Well, getting back to the comfortable middle class, when women started to advocate for equal political, financial and voting rights, women started teaching other women how to sew pockets into their clothes, which allowed them to navigate public spaces unaccompanied and carry important documents. For example, what became as the suffragette suit, popular in 1910, had at least six pockets. During World War I and II, women joined the workforce and gained more pockets, but when men came back to their jobs after the wars, women lost their jobs and their pockets, and the popularity of the handbag soared. Today, when designers don't include pockets in women's clothing, they are assuming women either don't need to carry anything or will have their hands free to carry a purse. Vestiges of the same sexist ideas that originally removed pockets from women's clothing. The Christian faith has a lot to say about the significance of clothes, especially as a way to practice faith and justice. The Bible dedicates whole chapters to Levitical garments, how they were to be made and who was qualified to make them. And in the book of Esther, Mordecai uses clothes to lament and protest injustice against the Jewish people by dressing himself in sackcloth and ashes as he wails through the city. And John the Baptist wore clothing made of camel's hair and a leather belt. And this was a protest against the long robes and comfortable lifestyle of the religious leaders of the day. That's still relevant, isn't it, really? You think about, you know, the terrific dress-ups in the Vatican. 50 years ago, Congress sent the Equal Rights Amendment to the states to be ratified on March the 22nd, 1972. And this amendment to the US Constitution was to prohibit any discrimination based on sex. Now, it met all the constitutional requirements to be added to the Constitution. It was ratified by 38 states, passed by a majority of Congress, and following the two-year waiting period after Virginia became the 38th state to ratify it, that figures, doesn't it, poor old Virginia. But even so, opponents claim that it shouldn't be added because of procedural questions. Gender justice advocates are asking Congress to remove the deadline that opponents have used to stall the Equal Rights Amendment. Advocates are also asking General Merrick Garland to withdraw the Trump administration memo that blocked the Equal Rights Amendment from being officially added to the Constitution. It's just astonishing this is happening now. Yes. Melania Trump did not ever speak much in public, but she certainly used clothes to make a point. Do you remember this amazing garment? It's in the book Fashionopolis. When American First Lady Melania Trump travelled to visit migrant children in a Texas detention centre in 2018, she was enrobed in an olive drab anorak by fashion house Zara. That's the Spanish retail thing. And these words were scrawled graffiti-like in white on the back. I really don't care, do you? Pundits opined that the jacket broadcast how Mrs. Trump truly felt about the locked-up kids, or her public duties, or her marriage. Her husband tweeted that it was her view of fake news media. Her spokeswoman claimed there was no hidden message. Well, she was right in a sense. The message was loud and clear. And it's a devastating reflection on how we live now. The jacket was, in effect, the most existential garment ever designed, made, sold and worn. Zara is the world's largest fashion brand. In 2018, it produced more than 450 million items. Its parent company, Spanish-based Inditex, reported 25 billion euros in sales in 2017, and Zara made up two-thirds of that. That's 19 billion euros. The jacket, which came from the company's Spring-Summer 2016 collection, retailed for $39. Yeah. To be able to sell clothing that cheaply and still reap a sizable profit, production is outsourced to independently owned factories in developing nations, where there's little or no safety or labour oversight. and wages are generally poverty level or lower. At the time workers were cutting and sewing Mrs. Trump's jacket, Amanda Ortego, the octogenarian co-founder and former chairman of Inditex, was the second richest person in the world after Bill Gates. The jacket itself is made of cotton, and of course conventionally grown cotton is one of agriculture's most polluting crops. Almost 1 kilogram of hazardous pesticides is required to grow 1 hectare. It was dyed and lettered with colouring agents while decomposing in landfill would poison the earth and groundwater. On average, the piece would be worn 7 times before it was tossed. But given the criticism thrown at Mrs. Trump for donning it on that visit, she probably won't ever put it on again. So, like most clothing today, to the dump. The jacket would go, I really don't care, do you?
It's dreadful, isn't it?
We are basically now still working to many of the same goals women advocated 100 years ago, including equal pay for equal work. We're also still working to ensure women and LGBTQ people have protections against all forms of gender-based violence and that those protections are fully enforced. Whose suffering are you wearing is a very interesting question. In continuing this good work, fashion continues to be on both sides. It's both the enemy in that story, but also a powerful tool. 2017 was a Women's March on Washington, when women and allies wore homemade pink hats made from patterns shared around the internet to protest Trump's inauguration and the derogatory comments he was making about women, and the negative impact many of his campaign promises would have on women and LGBTQ people. At the same time, these pink hats became emblematic of exclusionary white feminism that didn't make room for trans women or women of colour. But just as fashion and clothing can be used to exclude, it can also liberate. Sojourners magazine said Paola Fuentes Leghorn was an immigration women and girls campaigner at Sojourners magazine. Now Sojourners is a Christian progressive magazine. It's liberal, and for History Month in the US it just launched Clothing in Glory, Fashion, Faith and Social Justice, a place to practice dressing ourselves so we can seek justice in an embodied way. Now she writes, this writer, the spiritual discipline of getting dressed with intentionality helps us remember the goodness and glory of our bodies. Bodies made in the image of God who created us and loves us all equally, regardless of sex, gender, race, ethnicity, ability or sexual orientation. It's a space to think critically about what we wear, engaging with passion and advocacy to live our faith and advance justice. Getting dressed isn't something we simply think about or talk about, it's something we do. And for that reason, fashion is a spiritual discipline that is uniquely effective in helping us lament the injustices we see in the world. Fashion can be a direct response to the ways that our bodies are hurt or oppressed. When we pursue justice to protect our bodies, we reaffirm the glory of the image of God. You can see this is a very Christian perspective. Readers are invited to clothe themselves in glory this year as we advocate for a world in which all people are given equal respect, opportunity and protection. A sustainable world that pursues climate justice and a world where the rights of all workers are protected. Now that's got more of a Unitarian flavour, that last paragraph, hasn't it? It's powerful stuff. Clothing yourself in glory might be a bit overblown in expression for many of us, but I'm sure our Unitarian principles do clash with modern practices of outsourcing manufacturers of poor countries, sweatshop labour, exploitation of women and girls especially, and the use of synthetics, environmental degradation in cotton growing because of pesticide use and extensive irrigation. During the early stages of the pandemic, landfill became a big issue because the exports of unwanted clothes were interrupted. There is something appealing, isn't there, about the French way of dressing, which is to maintain a slim wardrobe of good quality clothing instead of cupboards, drawers, wardrobes, and indeed rooms stuffed with stuff. There is no prize for knowing which is the French lady's closet and which is the American lady's closet. My own family is quite divided on fashion. Some declare that appearances are not important. Others that you should do your best with what you have. It's a matter of self-respect as well as respecting others to turn out well. That's mum. Some of those who decry fashion and money wasted are doing the talk, not the walk. Mum used to have a bit of a giggle about Chris, who always said appearances didn't matter, and whenever he turned out for a bike race, he was always impeccably clad in the right lycra outfit and the correct shoes, and he looked as smart as paint. Certain labels and items of apparel do sing out powerfully to us. Buy me. You know you want me. I'd like to finish today with an item of clothing popular with men and women, boys and girls, but never owned once or worn in his whole 85 years of life by my dad, blue jeans. But it illustrates the complexities, difficulties and possibilities of change very well. 15 miles north of Nashville is Stony Creek headquarters. The desk is an old barn door on trestles. The entrepreneur in charge is that woman there, Sarah Bellos, 33 years old, and she wears her product, Gustin Jeans Dye with Indigo. Synthetic dye has been used in the USA and wherever jeans are outsourced, and that's happened for the last 100 years. It doesn't matter where you get your jeans, India, Bangladesh. The cheap and toxic synthetic had all but wiped out the indigo trade except for two countries. Japan, which terrific indigo, and also little bits of India. Bellos says the economics aren't there for people to care. You can buy benzene for people cheaper than paying a farmer to do crops. Pollution is the cheapest way to do business. Now the denim industry continues to rely on synthetic indigo for the same reason as fashion companies that have clothes made in sweatshops. But these economics are actually false, aren't they? Because they don't factor in health costs or environmental degradation. Aniline not only is a carcinogen affecting workers, two-thirds of it ends up in reservoirs, creeks, rivers, lakes, and in the air. And one-third, of course, is embedded in denim jeans, jackets and shirts. When I swim at the pool, one of the little bunch of regular swimmers worked in textiles for years, and he's actually quite right wing, but he's very strong on one thing. And that is that we don't pay enough for clothes. And the other is that if you do get clothes, wash them, wash them, wash them before you wear them. Now, Japanese indigo, that's the indigo that she's standing in, is dark green, bushy and a bit like giant basil. And it's bitter tasting even to insects, which reduces the need for pesticides. The magenta flowers attract butterflies, ladybugs and a red wasp that eats other bugs. Now you're probably aware that Tennessee was very much a tobacco state, and tobacco is hard work. You've got to plant it by hand and harvest it by hand. It's not a job that young Americans want to do. It's hot, nasty work. It leaches nutrients from the soil to the tune of about 300 pounds per acre, and it requires copious amounts of fungicide and herbicide. By contrast, indigo is a legume, like soy. The Japanese variety requires less than a quarter of that amount of supplemental nitrogen, and the two tropical varieties require none at all. Bellos had no trouble getting farmers to sign on, in spite of paying them less than half of what they'd get for tobacco. But their costs are so much lower, they pocket roughly $550 instead of $87 per acre. That's a huge difference. And the other thing is indigo can be mechanically harvested. In other words, it is a viable economic alternative, especially as American smoking rates have dropped and the manufacture of tobacco products has mostly been moved offshore anyway. Slow fashion, like slow food, has its part to play. A bevy of boutique denim brands have sprung up. In 2018, Meghan Markle wore a pair of Hoot jeans to an official visit in Cardiff that created months-long waiting lists for the manufacturer. For denim heads, selvedge jeans from Japan at the pinnacle. You see how the seam is a different colour? Japan has had an obsession with blue jeans since the 1940s. Ironically, the knockoffs have surpassed the originals in quality, proving that high-quality, desirable jeans can be made following the slow fashion model. This includes weaving the denim on selvedge looms, which are slow, but not as slow as the looms that weave kimonos. The other thing that's evident in factories all over that employ the genealogia system is the lack of masks that are needed when jeans are distressed. You know how old people don't like to wear jeans that look new? They've got to be distressed, they've got to be stonewashed. And it was done with acid and stonewashing, and now it's done with lasers and ozone. The new process of making jeans decreases energy consumption by 33%, chemicals by 67%, and the best of all, water by 71%. Or as the companies proudly boast, one glass of water per jean, as opposed to 18 gallons. It's 71 litres per pair, which is the traditional method. This technology can be found in Ho Chi Minh City, in the Levi factories in Turkey. Using less labour, less water and less energy puts modern production techniques on a sound economic footing, regardless of what's happening with trade. In the USA, Vidalia denim mills are providing 300 jobs to an economically depressed area. It sources sustainably grown cotton, that's not organic, just sustainably grown cotton from Mississippi. It's baby steps, but it's a start. One major takeout lesson though, people don't buy stuff because it's green. They buy it because it's cool. Human nature, great, isn't it? It occurs to me that we could be pretty proactive in this area. Years ago, the then Treasurer Martin Tucker became very interested in ethical investing and over time replaced investments in fossil fuels with greener alternatives. Well, we all wear clothes. We start by moving to a more minimalist model for purchasing, less quantity, more quality, like the French, as opposed to the American style. I'm pretty sure no one here wants to spend $2,000 on a pair of organically produced high-end fashion jeans, but like with all other innovations, the price comes down. That's where it was to start off with. Some very posh ones are now $200. You get them cheaper than that. The prices come down with volume. In the end, it's very much parallel to our purchasing of food. We know that $1 milk and $1 lettuce is unsustainable. It's just an aspect of very aggressive competitive marketing. We need to pay more than rock bottom prices for clothes, and we all know what our own budgets will permit. I do yearn for the days when smart casual clothing was manufactured in Burra, in Panova, and other country towns in Australia. Who knows, if anti-exploitation and anti-pollution measures are taken seriously, maybe smaller sustainable operations will start up here too. It's critical to listen to the words of people who make our clothes if we truly want to create a better fashion system. The last word today comes from Shauta Atka, a garment worker from Bangladesh. It looks like Bangladesh, doesn't it? If you pay a little more, we can live a little better. Thank you. Those were the three sources that I used today. One was the book by Dana Thomas called Fashionopolis. The other was Paola Fuentes-Glecon's article in the magazine Sojourners. And the other was that was the thing that got me going in the first place, and that was Portrait of a Lady on Fire, the 2019 film by Celine Sciamma. Just a reminder that our church is independent, not for profit, totally self-governed, and relies on generous contributions from people like you. Now, the words come from a Unitarian minister in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which of course, as you know, is a very, very industrial area indeed in the US. And here's what he has to say. Would you like to stand? Just if you're able. When I say go in peace, I don't mean go in mindless oblivion. When I say go in peace, I don't mean go without challenging yourself or others. When I say go in peace, I don't mean go in utter ease and comfort. When I say go in peace, I mean go in peace seeking justice. I mean go in peace committed to equal rights and opportunities for all. When I say go in peace, I mean go in the peace that is created when together we build communities of true solidarity, deep compassion, and fierce, unrelenting love. Go in peace.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitariansa@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.
Holding above it, I can't stop and say.